This is The Last Newspaper Reader, a book by Michael Angele, published in Germany by Galliani Berlin. Other than being the author of this tale, Angele is the editor-in-chief of German weekly Der Freitag. He is also just as addicted to newspapers as the protagonist of this story, the late Austrian author Thomas Bernhardt. Often considered to be one of the German-speaking world's most important post-war voices, Bernhardt wrote fiction, plays and poems, but is particularly famous for his proverbial pessimism, which is probably what made him such a devoted newspaper reader. In the first of our four-part serialization of this book, we find out that for Thomas Bernhardt, reading the paper was just as important as writing.
To this day, Thomas Bernhardt is the ideal newspaper reader in my eyes. By that, I don't only mean someone who'll sit down in a cafe simply to read a newspaper, regardless of whether this cafe may be in Vienna or Gmunden. By that, I also mean that he'll leave this cafe straight away if he can't find the newspaper he wants to read. Unfortunately, the reading of newspapers has been poorly explored in Thomas Bernhardt's life and work, but in the first instance, it will suffice to read his work yourself. By doing so, you'll discover that he had an existential connection to newspapers from an early age. If you're to believe his account, Bernhardt, as a young man, learnt of his mother's death in the Salzburger Zeitung. However, the Salzburger Zeitung misspelled his mother's name. Instead of Hertha Fabian, it said Hertha Pavian, the German word for baboon. When Thomas Bernhardt was mulling over this error at the funeral a few days later, he was overcome with such a violent fit of laughter that he had to leave the cemetery. To him, the world was both tragic and comic at the same time, and the majority of what he knew about the world he had, of course, learnt from the newspaper. Thomas Bernhardt, therefore, seems to be the ideal newspaper reader to me because he didn't simply read a newspaper to inform himself, although that was obviously part of it, but also to wonder, to be inspired, and above all, to work himself up. If you read the notes written by his neighbour in Elsdorf, the extent of Bernhardt's newspaper addiction becomes clear. The estate agent and pig trader Karl Ignaz Hennatmeyer spent a year recording his almost daily encounters, visits, car journeys and walks with Bernhardt. These recordings were published as a book entitled A Year with Thomas Bernhardt. One of the neighbour's main tasks was to supply Bernhardt with newspapers. He read 7 every day. A typical day in the life of Bernhardt in the year 1972 went something like this. Read newspapers in the morning, go for a walk in the afternoon, watch television in the evening. You might wonder whether Bernhardt ever actually read a book. The most famous passage about his newspaper addiction can be found in Wittgenstein's Nephew, a wonderful autobiographical text from 1982, when, during the Salzburg Festival, Bernhardt urgently wanted to read an article in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. He drove 80 kilometres from his home in Erlsdorf to Salzburg, from Salzburg to Bad Reichenhall, then to Bad Hall and from Bad Hall to Steyr. By the end of it, he'd driven across the whole of Upper Austria, looking for a copy of the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. And while only a few of his readers will be able to recall the individual stages of his search, the following sentence has been imprinted on many people's minds. No one with intellectual pretensions could possibly exist in a place where the Neue Zürcher Zeitung is unobtainable. Nowadays, you can get the NZZ virtually anywhere, online if needs be. Does that mean that an intellectual can exist virtually anywhere today? Or does it mean precisely the opposite, that there are no longer any intellectuals because intellect can only be formed where lack, absence and delay are present? I would argue the case for the latter, if my fear of cheap cultural pessimism didn't stand in the way. In order to read the NZZ that Thomas Bernhardt had searched for so desperately back then, I had to go on a journey of my own, albeit only as far as the newspaper archive in Berlin's Westhafen district. Since Bernhardt mentioned which article he'd been looking for in Wittgenstein's Nephew, a review of the performance of Mozart's Zaida in Salzburg, I found the issue. It's the one from the 30th of August, 1968. When flicking through the folios, I was first drawn to the mix of news. Diamonds had been stolen from an aeroplane when it was making a stopover in Beirut. A lorry had driven into a train on an unguarded level crossing in Martigny. Miraculously, this only resulted in minor injuries, although there was considerable material damage. The other accidents in the newspaper ended fatally. Those who read a newspaper in 1968 are not only aware of the Vietnam War and student unrest, they're also conscious of the great dangers of road traffic. Having said that, the Vietnam War is only a side note in this issue. The delegates of the 19th Vietnam Talks in Paris are fed up with the hotels and looking for apartments. In northern Italy, the students have returned from their summer holidays and have nothing better to do than resume their demonstrations. The NZZ correspondent works himself up, and I wonder whether Thomas Bernhard also read this article and worked himself up about the correspondent who's working himself up here. Reading newspapers as an art of arousal? Present is the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, which is a few days old. Perhaps a dozen articles attempt to describe the situation. In sport, the young Eddie Merckx gets a mention, and Leeds United are at the top of the Football League. The weather forecasts are miserable, and what do you go and do on a rainy weekend? You go to the cinema and find something to watch. The question is, what? In the summer of 1968, you could watch a spaghetti western. There's one running at the Roxy. Or Loves of a Blonde. It might sound like a porno, but it's actually the latest from director Milos Forman. But now to the arts section. Back then, the art section was still near the front of the NZZ. A poem jumps out. It's been translated from Czech. It could be read as an allegory in the context of the Soviet invasion. A small nation in the enemy's ocean, and so on. Too dull. Thomas Bernhard, who'd just stopped writing poetry at the time, certainly had the same thought. Perhaps he immersed himself in an article about the letters and diaries of the journalist Harold Nicholson. Nicholson must have been a massive snob. Why else would half the article consist of absolving him from the supposedly unfounded allegation of snobbery? But, of course, Thomas Bernhard first read the report about the Salzburg Festival. That was why he desperately wanted to have the NZZ. Zaida is a fragment of an opera that was only rarely performed. The article's very detailed. Every one of the rare performances is noted. After the premiere of Andreschen's version in Frankfurt, 1866, only in Vienna, Mannheim, Karlsruhe, Schwetzingen, and again in Vienna. Interesting. And yet, Bernhard travelled 350 kilometres for that? Newspaper readers have whims. In 1968, I was 4 years old. Of course, I only discovered Thomas Bernhard many years later. The same goes for reading newspapers in cafes, the way he exemplified. But I still enjoy reading the paper in a cafe today, even if us newspaper readers now form a minority in most of these cafes, unless it's located in Charlottenburg and frequented by so-called old 1968ers. At the moment, for example, I'm sitting in the Kant Café on Kantstrasse. It's not really old, not a Viennese coffee house, and yet it's preserved the cigarette smoke of many years in its yellowy-brown walls, chairs and tables. Even the big window looking out onto the street, although freshly cleaned, seems to recall its smokers who no longer exist. On the other hand, there's still a newspaper rack in the Kant Café. It's got a Taz in it and a Morgan Post, and precisely at that moment, yes, it's true, a woman walks up to my table and asks if she can have the Süddeutsche that's lying beside my laptop. The woman is maybe 60. Her hair's dyed henna red, her voice husky, her face raddled, wild dreams. I gladly give her the Süddeutsche. Later, an older man and an older woman are sitting in a corner. They're discussing a play. When they stand up, the woman says to the man, "Look, Christian's sitting over there." They mean me. I look up, smile at them and shake my head. "Of course you're not Christian. He always used to sit here. 20 years ago," she responded. Thomas Bernhard was obsessed with death, which we spend a lifetime keeping away from. Which some managed to do well, others not so well. And of course, Bernhard was one of those who managed not so well. But if you want to live, you have to make death wait and give life space. And something about this grand gesture of delaying repeats itself in the small steps to happiness. A cigarette addict postpones the moment in which they reach for the next cigarette, and there's already a certain joy in the anticipation, which is increased even more by the pleasure of their cigarette when it's finally lit. A newspaper reader sets aside an article they're particularly interested in to save for later. But we don't want to be addicts anymore and are in the process of squandering a piece of happiness. Not that we aren't actually addicts anymore. We're information addicts, communication addicts. But developing a small philosophy of postponement from this addiction seems impossible because everything's right there on our devices. And so people write guides and non-fiction books on detoxes. You read about self-experiments in which people have abstained from their mobile phones for weeks or months. But it can't be that either. So what is newspaper addiction? First of all, it's simply this. A newspaper isn't simply there. You need to get it, whether that's from the letterbox or you have to go to the cafe, such as the Kant Cafe. And if the newspaper is already there, if we want to read it, then it's only because someone left it lying there or because a Hennetmeyer brings it to us. And when we finally read it, we rarely read everything. Instead, we save a part for later. In a cafe, later could mean minutes later, sometimes hours later. Elsewhere, it means days, years, perhaps never. That's how a collection comes about. More on this later. The newspaper addicts are slowly dying out, but they still exist. You can observe them on Sundays as they buy their paper from the bakers. But I look forward to the Frankfurter Allgemeine Sonntagszeitung every Sunday morning and buy it when I finish my run. I'm soaked in sweat, and in winter my glasses fog up when I enter the Café Backshop Mühlenbeck, so I can no longer see anything, but I know where the newspaper stand is. At home I put the FRS on the kitchen table along with the bread rolls and a croissant for the little one, take a shower, and when I return, my wife's reading the politics section and offering her opinion. I listen and try not to come across as impatient because I'd actually like to read the newspaper myself. If I reply brusquely, it only worsens the situation because that can lead to serious disgruntlement at the table and you can't even think about reading the paper then. After reading the reports of the Bundesliga matches in the sports pages and asking myself why I'm actually doing that, since I've already seen the roundup on Das Aktuelle Sportstudio, I delve into the culture section and offer my commentary while my wife tries not to be ungracious on her part, although she actually wants to get to the end of her article. If there's something I really like, I rush to my laptop and post on Facebook. Friends, you have to read this. It's not online. Get the FRS, your press-cutting service. Others post links to Blendl in such cases. Not me. Not yet. I can't imagine a Sunday breakfast without the FRS and our exchange of opinions. Recently it was sold out at the baker's. Die Welt am Sonntag was in stock. I hesitated briefly, but then ran to the kiosk at the tram station to buy the FIS. A short detour of around 300 metres, that's nothing compared to the 350 kilometres that Thomas Bernhard travelled in August 68 to find a Neue Zürcher Zeitung. Whether he found one, the episode in Wittgenstein's Nephew doesn't reveal the answer. I couldn't find anything in the literature either. Thomas Bernhard's newspaper addiction has, strangely enough, been so poorly researched that I found neither an article nor a study on the meaning reading newspapers had for him, not even a reference to the existence of such a study. I inquired of author H, who qualified as a professor on the topic of Bernhard, so would be sure to know, but he couldn't think of anything concrete. He just said that Bernhard liked to stylise himself, and that possibly there wasn't a great deal behind his newspaper reading, in any case not behind his cosmopolitan posturing, the El País here, Le Monde there. H referred me to the publisher of the complete edition of his works, to whom nothing initially sprang to mind either. Could it really be the case that no one researched Bernhard's newspaper reading habit? And I don't mean essays along the lines of the role of the media in the late dramas of Thomas Bernhard, which obviously do exist. I write to the archive in Gemünden without a response. It later becomes clear to me why I don't get a response. The archive there had just closed. I found that out in an article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung about the squabble over the estate. If scholarly research doesn't have the answers, you have to ask contemporary witnesses. Klaus Peymann comes to mind. As the artistic director of the Burg Theater in Vienna, he made Bernhard a celebrated Burg author, and on his part, Bernhard penned three flash dramas to Peymann. One of them, Klaus Peymann buys himself a pair of pants and joins me for lunch, was later performed on television by Harold Schmidt and Benjamin von Stuckrad-Bahre. Peymann still works at the Berlin Ensemble. He met Bernhard on numerous occasions. He was a friend. Peymann will certainly be able to provide me with information. I send an email to the press department. I'm working on a study about the newspaper reader Thomas Bernhard, I write, grossly exaggerating. Please be patient, the press officer replied. Mr. Peymann is busy working on two premieres. We'll be in touch. I was patient. Sitting in a cafe and reading a newspaper on an ordinary day and looking onto the Kantstrasse, musing about the course of things, is one thing. But reading the newspaper in a hospital is another thing entirely. Just imagine someone who's narrowly escaped death. The worst is behind him, and he's happier by the day that he's still around. He can even leave his bed already. Every single step is still a challenge, but he forces himself to go to the hospital kiosk. There he buys himself a newspaper, and now he senses a great desire to read it. However, back in bed, he feels too weak to read the paper straight away. Not a problem. He can do it later, maybe even the next day. After all, he has his laptop. He'll just have a quick look at the day's events online. Of course, people used to read newspapers to inform themselves. You don't need to do that anymore. Then again, one didn't read a newspaper solely to inform oneself. Thomas Bernhard isn't an isolated case in that respect. He's exemplary. A newspaper was a doorway to the world, a piece of home, and its opposite when it expanded one's perspective. A newspaper was a fixed part of day-to-day life, when it was lying on the table at lunch, and at the same time, it transcended this day-to-day life. The newspaper is still a part of all of that, but all of that is slowly disappearing, because the paper's disappearing. It may be the case that this process will go on for years, centuries even. It may be the case the newspaper will even experience a small renaissance. But still, it is disappearing. No one's in doubt of that. But not everyone recognises the loss that this disappearance entails. A whole culture is, in fact, disappearing. And I'm not, in turn, able to discern that this culture is giving way to a new one that's just as rich, even though I have for a long time been a resident of both worlds, the analogue and the digital, and by now spend more time on Spiegel Online than reading the FAZ. The daily paper is disappearing because it is outdated, because a day no longer rules over the flow of information, that's true. But the speed at which a newspaper falls out of date was already an issue when only newspapers existed. "There's nothing older than yesterday's newspaper" is the signature of the newspaper era. But that doesn't always hold true. This sentence didn't hold true for Dee, for example, when he was in hospital reading the FAZ that he'd bought at the kiosk the previous day. Neither does it hold true for anyone who's on holiday. On the contrary, yesterday's newspaper is the best proof that you're really somewhere else. On vacation, you can only get yesterday's paper. If you've got your hands on a German newspaper from the same day, you may as well go straight back home. You're not on holiday. That's how it was in the golden age of newspaper reading. That's how it still is today. We spent our last summer holiday in Brittany. We rented a small house with a family we were close to in a hamlet a few kilometres from the coast. You couldn't buy newspapers in town. There weren't any shops at all. But of course we had our laptops with us and would get a guilty conscience whenever we booted them up. Not only to keep abreast of the Gaza war on Spiegel Online, but also to fritter away time on Facebook. The father of the family didn't go on Facebook very often. He read German newspapers and the NZZ on his iPad, and when later in the day we visited the small town on the sea, he bought Le Monde, Libération and Le Carnard Enchaîné. I kept quiet about the fact I was pondering about newspaper reading, that I might even write a little book about it. I didn't want him to feel like he was being observed and change his behaviour, a problem that's well known in the field of ethnology. If I'd told him, he might not have routinely shoved the newspaper in his trouser pocket and strutted through the small port town, from whose streets newspapers had as good as disappeared, whereby you have to admit that the place may be pretty, but it's geared up for regional tourism. Banalec's crime stories, which lure so many people to Brittany, are set elsewhere. Foreign papers were available in the stationery shop, but you had to ask for them. The shop assistant threw an unsorted bundle on the table, from which I pulled out the previous day's Süddeutsche, and sat down in the café opposite, from which the melody of a hit by Alphaville emanated. I flicked through the Süddeutsche and I looked over at the fishing boats, which were dozing in the midday sun. In the end, I'd only read the spotlight section, which I hardly ever read in Berlin anymore, although I often intend to. So I hadn't read a lot, but I had read the glossa, the satirical commentary, which is one of the best things about the newspaper, but which I read all too seldom. It felt good. L also only read a fraction of the French newspapers he'd bought. He immersed himself in Le Canard Enchaîné least of all. The articles in Le Canard are certainly very challenging, but the fact that he read so little of it, although his French is enviable, he studied in Paris, had another reason. Reading highbrow newspapers on holiday is like reading the local programme to see what you could do that evening, only to fall asleep in front of the television as soon as you get home from work. On average, you might read two articles, the main one on the front page and a medium-sized one inside the paper. Most attempts to save the newspaper assume that people want to read a newspaper. They don't consider that people might procure a newspaper simply to be able to read it. After all, that wouldn't make much sense. But that's how it is in many cases, and it applies to periodicals and magazines even more so. So not only did my friend hardly read the Canard Enchaîné, he also didn't work through the bundle of New Yorkers we'd brought along for him. Before getting on the plane with his family, he'd given us a suitcase that we had to squeeze into our car's roof box. We assumed it contained clothes and toys. It never crossed our minds that someone would have old issues of the New Yorker delivered to him. Neither is the obvious purpose of a collection of New Yorkers to read back issues on holiday, nor is the obvious purpose of a holiday to read old New Yorkers. But it did have its purpose. He read a couple of articles and seemed satisfied. This, too, is well known from the history of ethnology. The researcher takes on the behaviour of their research subject. We went on a trip to Paimpol. With the firm intention of buying a novel, I went into a bookshop and found a novel about Paris under Georges Pompidou. Later, I read about 20 pages on the beach, and never touched it again. It wasn't bad, but you should have bought Pierre Loti's An Iceland Fisherman, I told myself. That one is set in Paimpol. Then again, I wouldn't have read any more of An Iceland Fisherman than of Paris under Georges Pompidou. I wouldn't buy a novel in Berlin if I thought I was only going to read the first 20 pages, nor would my friend have slipped a newspaper in his trouser pocket. But you behave differently on holiday, behind the times, always living a bit in the past. People go on holiday to repeat previous holidays, which themselves were repeats of other holidays, namely the holidays from our childhood and youth. While on holiday, you're already planning the next one. How often do you promise, we'll be back, but how rarely do you actually go back again? Publishers would thus be well advised to focus the distribution of daily papers on holiday destinations and to direct all energy on these parts of the world. Particularly promising are the dated seaside resorts and the whole Italian Riviera. And publishers do seem to be doing so already. It's surprising where you can get your hands on the Süddeutsche or the FRZ. I tried to find out how many copies of the FRZ are sold in Italy. They didn't cough up the figures. But then you still can't buy the FRZ everywhere or at any time. The fact the newspaper is a rare specimen increases its appeal. It's the same for all good things. A few years ago, I spent a couple of days on the Greek island of Paros. I stayed in a former hotel, which is now a residence for authors from all over the world. You couldn't buy a German newspaper in town. It had preserved a certain backwardness that you could enjoy all the more, as the Greek crisis hadn't broken out yet, and you weren't forced to see this backwardness as a consequence of the crisis, giving you a guilty conscience. The fat butcher kept his meat cool without electricity. I bought my meat from him, not from the expensive supermarket at the top of the square, and felt good about myself. Every Monday, I took the bus some 20 kilometres to Parikia to buy myself an FRS and to read it on the terrace of the Toad di Strato Café in the shade of a chestnut tree. The bus that took me there was air-conditioned and punctual. As of a few years ago, the island had a well-developed bus and road network. That didn't suit me. I'd much rather have thundered along dusty roads on the edge of a cliff in an overheated rickety bus, all of it preferably in sepia and with a long but not hopeless delay. It wasn't always such a smooth affair. The autumn storms arrived and one of them was so powerful that the ferry from Piraeus was cancelled, and so the FRS didn't come either. For that reason, the Welt am Sonntag didn't arrive either, which I would have read at a pinch. I was in withdrawal and started to read the menu instead, which was written in English and Greek, and to arrange it according to absurd criteria. If you really want to read a newspaper and nothing else is at hand, you read the scrawny notices in the Government Gazette as if they were small aphorisms, and the offers on the leaflet from Lidl as if they were records from the sports page. And another newspaper I didn't read. It lay lonesome in a kiosk in Istanbul, which stood in a seedy corner of Sikeci railway station from where the Orient Express once departed. It was an FRZ from the previous day. It cost 9 Turkish lira, about 8 euros. I briefly considered it, and then decided not to buy it. But the longer I wandered around town, the more I came to regret my decision. I'd buy it on my way back. If I didn't buy it, I would later blame myself for such a pointless excursion. The newspaper addiction was once again so powerful that 8 euros really didn't seem too much for a newspaper. When I returned to the kiosk, the newspaper was gone. I had an accomplice. That was also worth something.
That was The Last Newspaper Reader, a book by Michael Angele, published in Germany by Galliani Berlin and serialized in the Monocle Winter Weekly. In part two of our serialization of this title, we delve into what it means to be a collector of newspapers and explore why Thomas Bernhard cherished the local dailies. There are musings over the places people pick to read their paper of choice, and inevitably, reflections on how the internet is changing everything.